This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening and welcome to Monday. It's a pretty chilly one in a lot of places around the country this Thanksgiving week. This hour, we're going to look at air travel from a couple of perspectives. We'll mark some sad days on the calendar with a discussion of the real people behind some statistics on gun violence in America. We'll have a look back 35 years at the environmental story that inspired the creation of the EPA Superfund program, Love Canal. And we'll have a moment of catharsis for the people of Dallas, a musical parting shot to a half century of grief. But we begin with a warming trend in the relationship between the U.S. and Iran.
The burden is on Iran to prove to the world that its nuclear program will be exclusively for peaceful purposes.
President Obama speaking about a deal to halt Iran's nuclear program and to begin talks on a much more complicated monitoring arrangement to see if Iran can prove that its nuclear program is for peaceful purposes.
Now the really hard part begins, and that is the effort to get the comprehensive agreement, which will require enormous steps in terms of verification, transparency, and accountability.
An historic deal, but a very long road ahead, according to Secretary of State John Kerry. Even a sustained conversation between the U.S. and Iran would be history-making, going back to the 1979 Islamic Revolution. But it's the forward motion that really matters here. Can the U.S. and Iran establish talks that could develop real momentum for skeptics in the international community? There are many people with long experience observing Iran's questionable intent about its nuclear program, which can also sound like strident saber-rattling at times. We'll hear from two of them now. Mark Fitzpatrick is with the London-based International Institute for Strategic Studies, but he spent years at the U.S. State Department as former Deputy Assistant Secretary for Nonproliferation. Fitzpatrick says the burden of proof question is a high bar. This will be no quick test for Iran to pass.
To prove that the program is strictly for peaceful purposes would take several years. It would take Iran to accept a more intrusive IAEA verification mechanism called the Additional Protocol, and the IAEA, over the course of several years, would have to be able to draw conclusions. There have to be an absence of any further indications of nuclear weapons-related work and so forth. It would be a long process.
Is there precedent for satisfying this burden of proof? And that really gets to what John Kerry was talking about. Enormous steps in terms of verification, transparency, and accountability. I mean, there's essentially going to be, it's going to be open season in Iran in terms of inspectors.
Not quite open season, but the amount of inspection is going to increase significantly. Iran being willing to accept inspections on a daily basis at their major nuclear programs, allowing inspectors to visit workshops for centrifuge production and assembly. Those kind of visits go above and beyond what is normally required of parties to the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. Is there precedent? Yes, there is a precedent in some other countries who have abandoned nuclear weapons pursuits. South Africa is the best example of that. But the difference, of course, is that South Africa actually produced nuclear weapons. Iran has not. Plus, South Africa had a regime change. Iran has not. And I'm not sure that Iran has yet made a strategic change of policy. What they've done is accepted more transparency measures and some very significant limits on the program. But, you know, they're not abandoning it by any means.
And there's also the Libyan example of giving up a nuclear program just sort of unilaterally. And again, there are important differences between what Libya did and what Iran is envisioned to do here. When you say it's going to take years, who's going to have to really hold on and trust that there is a process in place that at the end of which we'll be able to say whether Iran is serious or not? What nations, what institutions, what constituencies within the United States?
Well, trust is, of course, all going to be based on the verification. And luckily, there is a highly respected, highly professional UN body, probably the most professional, the most highly respected of the UN bodies, the International Atomic Energy Agency, will be continuing and heightening its inspection processes in Iran. On top of that, nations, particularly the United States, Israel, France, Great Britain, Germany, have a lot of intelligence agency attention to what's going on in Iran. If Iran were to violate any aspects of this interim deal, I'm pretty sure that both through those intelligence agencies and the inspections of the IAEA, that we'd know about it pretty soon.
Is there a such thing as a national right to enrich uranium for any reason in the world? Has the international community ever recognized such a right?
There's a huge debate over the right to enrichment. The NPT does not explicitly talk about a right to enrichment, but it implicitly does. I think you can read through the lines. At least that's my assessment. Most of the countries of the world go along with the view that the NPT does accord a right to enrichment because it doesn't prohibit it, and it talks about the right to peaceful uses of nuclear energy. But the United States, United Kingdom, France, and one other country don't agree with that. So there remains a legal dispute. And in this interim deal in Geneva, the parties agreed to fudge that difference by interpreting the treaty differently.
The Non-Proliferation Treaty, that's the NPT, that's referred to there by Mark Fitzpatrick, former Deputy Assistant Secretary for Non-Proliferation at the U.S. State Department. Thanks so much.
Sure. Happy to talk to you, John.
Picking up on this question of whether Iran or any nation, for that matter, has a right to enrich uranium for any purpose, that issue was quite apparent, and the divergent views among the parties also quite evident in statements over the weekend. Here's Secretary of State John Kerry.
This first step does not say that Iran has a right to enrichment. No matter what interpretive comments are made, it is not in this document.
But what does Iran say about that? Is it in the document, a right to enrich?
It says very clearly that Iran will have an enrichment program and it has a right to nuclear technology for peaceful purposes.
That is Iran's Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif speaking on NBC News. Is this a contradiction, some sign that these talks are headed nowhere, or one of the deliberate ambiguities that diplomats put into agreements that allows both parties to claim victory as the difficult bargaining begins? We pick that issue up now with Gary Sick, senior research scholar at Columbia University's Middle East Institute, author of All Fall Down, America's Tragic Encounter with Iran. Gary Sick, welcome.
It's good to be with you again.
So do you think this ambiguity is deliberate or a sign that, we're getting into an argument right off the bat?
No, it's deliberate. Everybody knew at the beginning that Iran would insist absolutely on having the right to enrich uranium on its own soil. And you can argue about the technicalities of that, but Iran was not going to do a deal unless they had that. We, the U.S. and some others, didn't want to say that explicitly, and so they've come up with a formula that, in fact, lets both sides interpret it their own way. That takes care of everybody's problems, and basically it isn't an issue. It will be more of an issue later on when you go past the next 6 months and we come to the negotiations of a comprehensive agreement with Iran. Then that issue may become more binding. But even then, if you look at back when Nixon's opening to China, they had the Shanghai Declaration in which the United States and China each took opposite positions and said they agree to disagree and left it at that, and that didn't stop the agreement from going through.
And the opening to China was preceded by a lot of secret negotiations, and indeed we learned that this agreement was preceded by a lot of secret negotiations between U.S. officials and Iranian officials. What do you make of those reports?
Well, I believe we talked some months ago, originally about this, when the idea of possibility of some kind of an agreement with Iran was beginning to emerge. And my advice at that time was we needed secret agreements. we needed secret contacts because we wanted to get some assurances on both sides before you actually get into the negotiating process itself. You want assurances from either side that they're really serious about this, they're prepared to go through, and get some sense of what they're prepared to put on the table. I think that was accomplished. The actual negotiation was done out in the open. It was done by the P5 plus one, the group that actually did the negotiation. But having that initial contact between the United States and Iran provided assurances on both sides that they were actually serious about this and that a deal could in fact be struck. That was very important.
From the perspective of Iran's domestic politics, what constituencies are going to have to hold the line and really maintain a consistent sort of message on non-proliferation if this deal is going to go anywhere inside Iran?
Well, we're seeing the forces line up in Iran already. There were people who were very unhappy with the agreement, the way it came out, made clear that they were. On the other hand, there were cheering crowds that greeted the foreign minister as he arrived back in Tehran, and the supreme leader and President Rouhani, the new president of Iran, exchanged letters in which they were congratulatory toward the people who had done the negotiation, and it in effect blessed the deal as far as the supreme leader was concerned. So basically, the Iran has choreographed this rather carefully internally to avoid the problems that they had in the past, where they cut a deal too quickly and the supreme leader didn't like it or some other party didn't like it. The Revolutionary Guard, which is the most important single institution in Iran, has not really spoken on this subject. They've kept very quiet, and basically that's a very good sign.
Hmm. Speaking with Gary Sick, senior research scholar at Columbia University's Middle East Institute, the Israelis have said very openly, Bibi Netanyahu, the prime minister of Israel, has said openly it's a more dangerous world because of this agreement. Is there any bar that Iran could reach on this question of a nuclear program, do you think, that would satisfy Israel?
Well, first of all, the people who are really criticizing it most strongly, I think it's very, very clear, they don't want a deal at all. They really want a gun held to the head of Iran. They want Iran to be isolated from the rest of the world and cut off, and that unable to play a role in international politics. That is the real objective. If you look at it purely in terms of the nuclear side, look at what Netanyahu said to the UN when he held up that famous cartoon and drew a red line. Basically, what Iran is proposing right now and what the agreement calls for is within the next 6 months, instead of being approaching that red line that Netanyahu was talking about, it will disappear completely. That the threat that he was holding out of what could possibly happen in 2014 and possibly require a war, actually will disappear completely. That entire threat that he talked about at the UN. You don't hear him mentioning that. But the reality is that this does resolve many, if not most, of the issues that were regarded as the most threatening things that Israel faced as far as the nuclear program was concerned. So, I take with a very big grain of salt the opposition that has been raised. The opposition really says it's an agreement, but it's not perfect. It doesn't do everything we would like to have it do. Therefore, it's no good at all. Well, and that's not a legitimate point of view.
And we will see if momentum can be developed over the next 6 months as the serious negotiations begin. Gary Sick, senior research fellow at Columbia University's Middle East Institute, author of All Fall Down, America's Tragic Encounter with Iran. Thanks so much, Gary.
Good to talk to you.
So stay with us. Tell us your story. Respond to anything on the program at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Some thoughts now on the calendar, the numbered days that measure out our years. I say November 28th, and you know it's Thanksgiving this year. I say December 14th, and you may wonder why. But if you're from Newtown, Connecticut, December 14th is a day like no other. We all expect to be reminded of the first-year anniversary of the deaths of the children and teachers at Sandy Hook Elementary School. Authorities are releasing a report this week on that shooting. But since that tragic day in Newtown, 30,000 people have died from guns in the United States, according to estimates from the Centers for Disease Control. The CDC also says that for children ages 15 to 19, gunshot injuries rank second only to motor vehicle crashes as a cause of death. Moments that become tragic marks on a calendar. August 24th, 2012, April 22nd, 2013, or September 14th, 2012.
My son became another statistic. And that was something I said he would never be. My son will not be a statistic.
Aisha Tyree speaking about the loss of her son, Kaim, on September 14th of last year. She is one of the voices in a year-long series from Kathleen Horan, a reporter at WNYC Radio. A look at each of the children in this city who died from gun violence over the course of a year. 10 dates, 10 names, 10 families. In Harm's Way, the series is called, from August 2012. To August 2013. Kathleen, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
So tell me about how the dates on the calendar really became families, people, real, real stories. Tell me about August 24th, 2012. That was the place you began this series.
whenever there's a homicide, I get an email that lists a very brief narrative. And I learned that a 13-year-old black young man was shot in the back in Brownsville, Brooklyn.
And the first thing you learn is the name.
Just the name, the hour of the day, where it happened, and that this person was rushed to the hospital and that they died.
What did you learn about Ronald Wallace subsequently in this case?
That he was out with friends. He was doing regular teenage activities. He was coming back from McDonald's with a group of kids. And it was one of the last days of summer, and he was just out enjoying himself. And then a bunch of kids walked up and said, "What's up?" And he was shot in the back.
And, of course, he had a mom. This is you speaking with Ronald Wallace's mom back in August of last year.
He was the lightest baby inside the nursery. Chunky. He was smart. He was a smart baby. Like, who would do that to my Jeff? He's not that kind of kid. Nobody understands what I'm going through. I'm hurt. My heart is hurt.
How difficult was it to approach these people, and how welcoming were they to talk about these people that they'd lost?
It was really difficult because you're trying to talk to people on the worst day of their life, and it's not a welcome visit. It's not a welcome visit at all. But over time and with patience, the families did want to talk about their loss, so it would be somehow less senseless, so people would remember who this person was, that they weren't just detail on a police sheet.
Oh, indeed, your reporting is about the remembering that all of these families want to do. They don't want to let go of these memories.
But it's a process. The first few days, usually, or week or 2 weeks, families don't want to talk about it, and they resent that you would come and visit them because it just reminds them about what happened.
So tell me about April 22nd, 2013, a 17-year-old victim in this case.
That was Alphonza Bryant. He was also out with friends, just hanging out, enjoying himself. And he was also shot and killed just in the early evening.
And again, another mom, another loss, and another set of memories.
So I tell him there's got to be only three people that can go in, and this girl steps forward right away. And she says, "I'm his ex-girlfriend and my name is Yancy." And then it was just funny from there because then all of these other girls just started coming out of the woodworks like, "No, I'm his girlfriend. No, I'm his girlfriend."
He just had the game.
He had the mojo. He had the power.
You know, one of the things that's striking about Janai Van Doten, who's Alphonza Bryant's mom, is a sense of acceptance. There's a certain kind of humor there that's as though this is what happens in our neighborhood. It's hard to listen to a little bit.
She's gone through many different stages, and she's joked because all of these kids were as weird and funny and complex as any other kids. And so she was explaining what a ladies' man he was. But she also asked the medical examiner if he died hungry. She asked if he had anything in his stomach. I mean, this is a woman who's been tortured.
What was the answer?
The medical examiner reassured her and said, yes, he had eaten.
What is the impact on these communities and these families in the sense that in a city that is supposedly safe, and the stats would say that here in New York, these people in these neighborhoods don't feel safe?
It really, it's crazy making because, you know, parents have told me they turn on the radio, they read the newspaper, and what they hear is that crime is down. And yet their experience is much different. Not only losing their child, some of these kids lost their fathers also to gun violence. There's just a lot more evidence of minor and major crime where they live.
And even though you tried to bracket it into a year from August to August, even for you, the story goes on.
It does. It's not going to end. And it'll be interesting to see what happens. You know, crime goes up and down. But how, you know, because these crimes happen to kids that are just black and brown, you know, just like it mirrors more of the statistics, you know, more than 95% of the people killed in the city are black and brown.
The two cities.
Right.
Right. A tale of two cities, 10 families, 10 stories, 10 tragedies. Kathleen Horan, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Kathleen Horan is a reporter at WNYC, joined us to talk about her series, In Harm's Way. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Some thoughts now about air travel from the inside and the outside. First, as the flying experience has changed over many decades, so has the manufacturing process for making airplanes. Boeing, one of the largest aircraft manufacturers in the world, a huge exporter of commercial and military jets, is also home to a large union workforce centered in Seattle, where the company started in 1916. That has been changing for years. More and more work contracted out or actually moved to places far from Washington State. And now, after a recent union vote by machinists to reject a new contract offer, Boeing may be threatening to find a place to build the new 777X jet, where unions have less of a foothold. Washington state workers claim they have the most experience in aviation, and the state just approved $8.7 billion in tax incentives. But as aviation industry analyst Scott Hamilton explains, the outside offers are numerous and tempting.
Boeing is talking about outsourcing it from Washington, if you wanted to describe it that way. But they're also talking about putting it at other Boeing facilities in other states. Boeing really has been at war with its unions, the IAM, which does the touch labor, and SPIA, the engineers union, which does all the engineering. They've been at war with those two unions for a number of years now. Boeing has been moving work out of the state of Washington, some work overseas. That's your true outsourcing. Some work to other Boeing facilities, both in right-to-work states and in California, which, of course, is not a right-to-work state, but down in California, it's a different union altogether.
I'm wondering if part of what's driving this is the fact that Seattle has become a high-tech center independent of the aviation industry, with Microsoft there, with Amazon there, with so much of the tech and computer industry based there, and a hugely competent workforce working in that field, but largely non-union. Does that make the point that you don't have to be unionized to function in the tech space, and that Microsoft's success is motivating Boeing as well?
When Boeing put the second 787 line down in South Carolina, there were some special circumstances involved in that. Boeing had to buy those facilities from Vought and Global Aeronautica, which was a joint venture between Vought and an Italian company. The work was going so poorly by Vought and Global Aeronautica that Boeing bought that facility, and now they owned it and decided to put the second line down there simply because they had come off of a strike with the IAM that lasted 57 days in 2008, and they were just tired of having these production interruptions. So I don't think that the Microsoft type of connection is really what's driving this. They're tired of dealing with the IAM. They're tired of having the potential of strikes at the end of every contract, and they just want to diversify from this strong union up here.
Looking from the union point of view, does the union have a point, have an argument? We have the clout to call the shots here, and you can't build this plane without us?
Well, that's what the union likes to say. The union does actually have a point that they, of course, are the experienced workforce. They know what they're doing. They point to the continuing problems down at Charleston. And, of course, that plant has been in operation for 8 years now. It's only been delivering airplanes for the past year. But quite frankly, Boeing Chicago, the headquarters in Chicago, has more leverage than the union does. The union has leverage in being able to strike at the end of any contract, and if you don't reach an agreement. But that's why Boeing is wanting to open up other facilities and move work out of the state of Washington.
Scott Hamilton is an aviation industry analyst based in Washington State. Scott Hamilton, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Attention holiday travelers, the Federal Communications Commission may be willing to allow you to sing jingle bells to someone back home while you are in flight. The FCC apparently ready to make a decision on whether to lift the ban on cell phones. Unlike the Federal Aviation Administration's recent decision to allow other electronic devices during takeoff and landing, the cell phone proposition has flight crews up in arms. Passengers aren't so sure how they feel about it either. One of you in Cambridge, Massachusetts, it's a terrible idea. I don't want to hear a person's conversation with no ability to walk away. For more on the changes ahead and what you can expect as the holiday travel season kicks off, we turn once again to Barbara Peterson, senior aviation correspondent for Condé Nast Traveler. Barbara, welcome.
Great to be here.
And it's holiday time. What's the jurisdiction here? The FAA has some jurisdiction. The FCC has jurisdiction.
Yes. Well, it's really funny because a lot of people assume it's just the Federal Aviation Administration that regulates the airlines. But actually, the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission, does have a role here, which is they have to make sure that a plane full of people screeching into their smartphones isn't going to disrupt cellular networks on the ground. And there is a risk of that. But they're moving now to saying, wait, these restrictions are really outmoded. There are new technologies available now to the airlines that really wouldn't interfere at all with the ground networks. And the other thing that I think a lot of people don't realize is a lot of airlines overseas already permit people to use their mobile phones. So it's not unprecedented. We've had more than 5 years of experience with how it's working elsewhere in the world.
Can I ask you a kind of a techie question? You know, nowadays you can't use cash on airplanes. They basically take your credit card and they swipe it when you're getting food or something to drink. That uses the same technology as a cell phone, right? That little swiper deal?
Yes, but I think the key is how much and what type of strength the signal is. And I think that a lot of people are just concerned that if you have, again, if you have a whole plane load of people using their phones to make calls, that would really pose a different kind of issue. I must say, though, I don't think that scenario really is that realistic because, frankly, it's going to be horrendously expensive. You'll probably get charged international roaming rates if you call
from really?
A plane.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, so I don't think people are going to be blabbing on for hours about their gum surgery or something and annoying everybody around them. I think that
annoying me now. Yeah. So how do you deal with this? Amtrak, of course, has a quiet car. I mean, there's no real structural way of dealing with this inside the aircraft to prevent someone from talking or to create preference seating, right?
Well, that would be another option for the airlines if they choose to and if they think they can make money out of it. I mean, some of the ideas being bandied about already are maybe creating a little phone booth in the back of the plane and you'd reserve your time there. And of course, that's taking up precious space. And most of the times when airlines take something out of a plane, they want to put something in that will make money. So they'd have to figure out how to make that work. One other commenter that I read online was concerned that people are now going to go in the lavatories and use that as their private phone booth, and they'll stay there for, I don't know how the flight crews are going to regulate that. So I think that's why we've heard so much blowback from the airline employees on this one.
Technologically speaking, I mean, originally it wasn't just about cell phones. It was about all electronic technology creating some sort of interference that would get in the way of navigation. You don't really hear about that much anymore. Is that because the navigation technology has advanced to the point where there isn't that interference, or the technology itself doesn't put out those interfering waves?
Yes. Well, it is the advent of these new technologies that were first tested in Europe about 5 or 6 years ago. And those are very different than when, I don't know, maybe some of your listeners remember there were these clunky things called airphones that were in the seat back.
Yeah, sure.
And those were not only very expensive to use, but there was only one per every three seats or so. But, you know, we have had experience with phones on planes before. This is not unheard of. And, you know, a lot of people didn't use those either because, again, you know, the sticker shock when you open your bill, you know, the yep. next month was pretty bad.
You flying for the holidays?
I'm going to stick to the roads.
Right. Barbara Peterson, senior aviation correspondent for Condé Nast Traveler. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Today, the Retro Report documentary team takes us back to the calendar of 1978 when residents of Love Canal in Niagara Falls, New York, got some shocking news about the disposal of toxic chemicals in their community.
For several years, chemicals have been seeping into the basements of a number of houses, including this one. The evidence is always there. There have been instances of birth defects and miscarriages among neighborhood families.
Suddenly, residents like Lois Heisner had to face the fact that their lovely little spot in the world, their community, wasn't so much about love, it was potentially poisoning them.
I am really, really afraid. We have decided we're going to get out one way or another. But right now, you know, you just can't jump, and where are we going to go?
35 years later, J.P. Olson, producer for Retro Report, looked back at this story and went back to the community to find out more about what's happened since. J.P., welcome.
Thank you.
So there's been a lot of mythology that's grown up around Love Canal. The memories are vivid, but the history is complicated. What did you find?
Well, the first thing that I didn't realize in looking at Love Canal is that there were actually two evacuations. And I think in the public mind generally, it's one evacuation. The entire town empties out. But in fact, it was over the course of 2 years. There was an initial evacuation that happened relatively quickly, a couple of months when waste started coming out of this canal, this dumping site. And then a second evacuation happened about 2 years later. And in that time, there was an incredible amount of strife between the local community and activists in the community and the state and federal government.
Here's a voice of one of the, I guess we would call him evacuees, Joseph Retton.
I was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer 3 years ago. And I'm stage four cancer. It's went to my liver. I worked at chemical plants. I was exposed to Agent Orange. I live in Love Canal. I don't know where my cancer comes from.
Joseph Retton's emotion there is really what the story is all about. There's a level of confusion and suspicion, but no certainty.
Cancer is a very difficult thing to understand. Very few kinds of cancers are recognizable to be have come from a particular source. And so in the case of a Love Canal scenario, you have people who clearly are getting sick. Now, whether those numbers are extraordinarily high remains a question depending on who you talk to. But the fact is, if you get cancer and you live near that canal, you could imagine that your mind would go there.
What chemicals were in the Love Canal?
Well, there's more than 100 chemicals in it, and these are all byproducts from different petrochemical companies and industrial works that were going on at the time. You know, the ones that were the most concerning at the time were dioxin, which clearly has been linked to all kinds of health disorders, and there's other benzene and a number of others are in there. I mean, many, many, many. And one of the issues that's difficult is when these chemicals are combined, it's impossible to even know specifically what you're dealing with.
One of the things that is clear is that Love Canal really inspired the creation of the Superfund approach to cleaning up intensively degraded toxic waste sites. First of all, how did that happen and what's happened since the whole Superfund idea?
Well, Lois Gibbs is a local resident and became an activist and really drove this issue into the public in a really very effective way. And as time went on, I think it was recognized that, you know, you have these residential communities that are near factories and there are all kinds of, you know, potential environmental insults all around them. And prior to that time, you know, communities would stay and get sick and often be reassured by the company that everything was fine when in fact it may well not be. And so this was a real sort of change in the mindset that if someone's getting sick near hazardous waste, you need to get people away from it. That seems like an obvious thing at this point. But up until that time, that wasn't something that was necessarily going to be considered. So Superfund, what happened was that essentially the cost of remediation of something like this is so great that there's no way, given the number of sites around the country, which are something like 4,000, that the federal government could shoulder the cost. So the legislation became that you would be able to go after the company that initially had left this waste. And in some cases, and this is where it became complicated, in some cases you're talking about a company that bought a company that bought a company. But it doesn't matter at this point. The point is that if you bought a company that 80 years ago dumped waste, you're responsible for it even up to this day.
And the EPA really made cleanup of Love Canal a real mission. Here's Mike Basile of the EPA.
I think there's a legacy of doubt because people think that someday the landfill will leak. But we have monitoring wells around this site. So red flags would go up if there was a problem. The homes around Love Canal, especially the homes that were rehabilitated, where people are living in them today, is probably one of the safest places on the planet to live.
True. Can we believe that? The stigma of Love Canal goes way, way beyond the half-life of even, you know, plutonium.
Yeah. I mean, it's a difficult thing to say this is the safest place on the planet to live. But that's certainly the EPA's position has been that for a long time. If you go to the neighborhood today, as I did, my impression has been that most of the people living there feel like it's fine and they don't have concerns. And in fact, the number of people who live there, it's essentially a fully occupied neighborhood at this point. But there are people who feel like it's harming their health. And it appears to be that number of people who are at least considering whether or not health concerns that they have now may be related to that. But, you know, I think it's one of these issues. It's very difficult for anyone to really answer with any kind of certainty. The federal government has its position, which is that this is a safe area, that it's being carefully monitored. And if it started to leak and chemicals were getting out, there are so many redundancy plans in place that you would know. Now, on the other side of this, you have an activist group that says, listen, you know, people are getting sick and they seem to be unexplained sicknesses. So what are we supposed to make from this? We don't think that it's safe. And I've come to see this story as basically when you were a kid and you would look at that old diagram of or a drawing of is it an old woman or is it a young woman? And it depends on your perspective and how you're going to look at it, whether or not you're going to see one or the other. And at times you can see both, but certainly it's a divided issue.
Put you on the spot, though. Would you buy a house there?
If I were moving to Niagara Falls, which I wouldn't be moving there unless there was a reason, like a job, for example, I probably would think twice about living there. That said, people that I met who were living there didn't seem to have a problem living there.
J.P. Olson, producer for Retro Report, looking back 35 years after the designation of Love Canal as a toxic waste site. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
To see a video of Retro Report's findings, you can visit thetakeaway.org. There is a chance, maybe more than just a chance, that the people of Dallas, Texas got the opportunity to experience a kind of emotional closure from all of the 50-year commemorations of the Kennedy assassination. What you are listening to is a part of all that. The Brentano String Quartet performing in Dallas over the weekend the piece One Red Rose by composer Stephen Mackey.
That was cool. Okay. I really heard all those phases. And it had a real narrative to it. Let's do that.
The creation of this piece of music was a complicated journey for the composer and the performers, and we got to come along. At a rehearsal earlier this month, Mackey and the quartet shared their artistic vision and their own emotional experience of an event most of them were not alive for. On their way to Dallas, they had performed the piece for audiences in New York and New Jersey.
One of the things that's wonderful about this piece is that it does address this issue directly of what happened 50 years ago.
We play mostly for an older audience. That's just how chamber music is. And so a huge percent of our audience at any given concert did live the event. And in fact, many of them were even adults already at that point.
On more than one occasion, there are people that have come up to us and that said, thank you so much. And there are so many things that happened on that day, and something about the music really brought it all back.
I know a lot of people who have very strong memories of that day, and I feel like I can relate now. That's what studying history does, I think, connects us to outside ourselves, to our past.
Brentano String Quartet members Nina Lee, Misha Amory, Serena Cannon, and Mark Steinberg. But it was the upcoming experience of performing in the place where President Kennedy was killed that composer Stephen Mackey was most anticipating, an event he prepared for like a historian as much as a musician. What's going on in that really dissonant section you were rehearsing with some effort there? What's the image, the sense of chaos, I suppose.
The chaos of it. The ugliness stopped me, actually, at one point. I made the mistake of watching the Zapruder home movie, and I was paralyzed for weeks after that. I thought, you know, oh, this is horrific. I mean, you see depictions of it, even, you know, Hollywood movie depictions, and you read about it, and there's something about the actual home movie of the actual event of a bullet piercing the president's skull that, instead of inspiring me, scarred my imagination instead of stimulating my imagination. And I didn't work for weeks. And then as I came back, I thought, okay, I want to have some of the ugliness, but I am going to make it a more generalized chaos. You've got several frantic threads happening at once. You've got the manhunt for Oswald. You've got the president rushing to the hospital. You've got the press in an era before, you know, Wi-Fi and cell phones getting to, you know, the story to where they had to be. You have the, you know, police station itself. And so I'm thinking of all of those things, but I'm also thinking of just the ugliness of a human being firing a gun at another human being's head.
Why One Red Rose?
when the president was delivered to Parkland Hospital, the Secret Service examined the limo, and all they saw on the floorboard there was one blood-soaked red rose.
Do you have a thought process, something that's swirling around in you as the piece ends in that powerful harmony, that everything sort of held up by that powerful cello theme that's going on? What's going on inside of you as you're writing it, as you're hearing it?
I was thinking positive thoughts, to be simplistic about it. I was thinking of uplift. I was thinking of, you know, pulling together. In my personal connection to it was, you know, I was thinking about my parents who were really attached to Camelot and the Kennedys.
And where were you 50 years ago?
I was home sick in Marysville, California. I had the flu that day, so I got to stay home from school, and I was watching cartoons, and the news flash came in. Immediately, I heard the neighbor lady, Mrs. Tui, run into our house and shout the news to my mother, and then I heard my mom and Mrs. Tui break down sobbing.
Do you think people individually moved on from the Kennedy assassination, and that's kind of what happened? Or did America collectively move on? I sometimes don't know if it was both or if it was just one.
I put all my eggs generally into the individuals. I mean, I think, you know, in terms of change, you know, even political change, things change because individuals change, and important individuals change, and enough individuals change. I don't think the country can move on unless all the individuals move on, and I think that's debatable whether that's happened.
How much Dallas is in this? How much of Dallas's own community interest in commemorating this is a part of this art here?
I did a lot of research. I really put myself into this and really tried to connect with the specifics of that event.
You right? went to the book depository.
I did go to the book depository, yeah.
You went to Parkland Hospital.
I did go to Parkland Hospital, yeah. Watched old newsreels. It's, you know, and I'm not trying to depict those. What I'm saying is that I was thinking of, you know, the cocking of a gun, you know, and the clank of a shell on the floor of that sixth floor depository as a rhythmic event, you know, pulling away just the acceleration away from the grassy knoll.
I mean, the people of Dallas are unique in this, in the sense Absolutely. That they carry a great burden of shame and a sense that America blamed Dallas on that day, that you will be a part of possibly liberating them from. It would be different for that audience than almost any other audience. Mm.
The main theme is this public performance of grief versus the, you know, the private experience of tragedy and grief. That gets me out of being a historian. When I think of Dallas, I still have ringing in my head the excitement that Jackie and JFK had waking up on a sunny morning. It turns out, you know, the rain stopped. It was sunny. They could go with the top down. The streets were lined with people cheering. And Jackie, you know, leans into JFK and says, you know, "See, Jack, they love you in Texas." Texas showed up and, you know, celebrated him. And is this, you know, this one guy in the sixth floor, it's just this one, you know, kind of lunatic. It has nothing to do with Dallas in that sense.
As we were there in that New York apartment listening, after a while, the music began to convey to us an emotional depth from an event 50 years ago, coming through in the deep notes of Nina Lee's cello. The Brentano Quartet performing Stephen Mackey's One Red Rose on Saturday night at Dallas's City Performance Hall. Thanks to our friends at KERA 90.1 Dallas for the recording of Saturday's concert. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Huckenberry. This is The Takeaway.